One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
All right, Majority Report listeners, we have a final deal. As you know, Credo is sponsoring the show for the rest of 2013, just a couple more days. We have a final deal that ends on New Year's Eve. You will be able to get, with Credo Mobile, a free Google Nexus 5 and an up to $350 buyout credit. That means they'll give you a credit on your Credo bill for up to $350 to get you out of your own old contract, plus a free Google Nexus 5. You know all about Credo Action. They fight for progressive values. Credo Mobile gives 1% of its revenue to fund progressive nonprofits. Check it out. Go to credomobile.com, Sam, for your deal. This is only good until the end of the year, and then it all goes away. CredoMobile.com/Sam. We've got links on the front page of Majority.fm. Check it out now.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, December 27th, 2013. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's the best of 2013, folks. It's so casual, we're not even here. I'm napping right now, if all has gone well. And hopefully I've returned from my journey to the center of the earth, or at least the middle of our country, where I had spent the holidays with my in-laws. The kids have slowly calmed down. My headache is starting to subside. And now, undoubtedly, I have a list of things to do provided to me by Nikki. Things that I have neglected throughout the year. So I'm busy doing that stuff. But for you, ladies and gentlemen, we have a great talk that I had back in August of this year with Professor Eddie Gloud on the, or if not the, but very close to the week of the anniversary of Martin Luther King's March on Washington. And it's a fascinating conversation, one that I really enjoyed. Professor Eddie Gloud, one of my favorite guests. And so enjoy that. And for members, we have another deep archive. We interviewed Stephen Colbert back on the Majority Report back in February of 2006, when the Colbert Report was just starting out, I think. It was not the powerhouse that it is now.
Just an oogle. Ogle?
It was an ogle.
Ogle. Stephen Colbert's eye.
Actually, no, it was actually happening. But so members will get that bonus. I don't know if Matt has decided to add some little other snippets here or there, as he's wont to do, of our best ofs of 2013. I remind you, we rely on your support for this program. So if you can become a member, do so at Majority.fm, but why not just get the app at majorityapp.com? It's a great way to share the program with other people. So easy to get the app, or give us a good review on iTunes. In the meantime, sit back, listen to Professor Eddie Gloud. We'll be back this time next week. All right, folks. Get ready for New Year's. It's coming up. All right. I don't know what that was about. I'm just... I hear the music still going, and so, all right. Okay, here it is. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Eddie Gloud. He is a professor of religion and African-American studies at Princeton. Welcome back to the program, Professor.
It's always a pleasure to dialogue with you, Brother Sam.
So now, exciting. We are on the cusp of a 50-year anniversary of the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. And it's the march is, I think, at this point, most famous for Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Put this into context for us before, because I want to talk about how this march was developed and get into sort of how, in some respects, there's been it's fair to say revisionist history of what the meaning of the march was, but certainly it's been filtered in some way. But put it in context for us.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to kind of think to understand the history of the March on Washington. It comes out of the March on Washington movement, which lasted from 1941 to about 1946. And was rooted in the efforts of A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and others. A. Philip Randolph, of course, one of the organizers of the Black Pullman Porters, and alongside Chandler Owen in New York, was part of a kind of black labor movement, in some ways the cornerstone of a black labor movement. And then Bayard Rustin, of course, coming out of an organizing tradition of friendship, fellowship, Quaker tradition, pacifist tradition. So it has its origins in this effort to push the president to respond to the economic circumstances of black folks. So there was this desire to push Franklin Delano Roosevelt to really respond to the dire circumstances of black folk in the country. So it was supposed to be a massive mobilization in which black folk and their friends would come and in some ways occupy D.C. to bring pressure to bear on the federal government to address the circumstances of everyday ordinary folks. That movement was extended, and Bayard Rustin brought it into 1963 as a part of the Civil Rights Movement. And initially it was supposed to be a massive sit-in of everyday ordinary folk, of black workers, of poor people, of sharecroppers, to bring attention to the devastation that took place in the South, to bring attention to the movement that was going on in the South. So it was supposed to be a massive act of civil disobedience, Sam. And, you know, the story, of course, you know, Malcolm X has the famous description of the March on Washington as the farce on Washington, right, that the federal government realized, Kennedy realized that this was going to be a massive act of civil disobedience, decided to get in front of it, and in some ways transformed it or redirected it to become a kind of mobilization in support of legislation that would eventually be the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
It
has this radical origin, and then it gets transformed.
Yeah, I mean, that's the part that really fascinates me. And to a certain extent, we see how that has reverberated through the decades. I think in common parlance, it's referred to the March on Washington, and that part about for jobs and freedom gets lost here. And you know, I think it was on Twitter when you had mentioned that you were thinking about Malcolm X's perspective mm-hmm. on this, and you know, from his autobiography, he really talks. He discusses this march in the context of really co-optation in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's really bizarre, you know, in this sense that, again, it was supposed to be a massive act of civil disobedience to call attention to the prevalence of discrimination in the South and throughout the country, and it was in some ways not only co-opted but absorbed, and we can see that now. I mean, look at it. President Obama will be speaking, right,
on
the 28th at the Lincoln Memorial, right? Unlike the previous presidents, like I would prefer him to be perhaps speaking in the well of Congress, pushing a jobs bill to respond to the devastating unemployment figures in Black America. I would prefer him pushing legislation from the White House, as J.F. Kennedy was trying to do, you know, actually working politically as opposed to getting in front of this memorialization. So, but it is a kind of example of the way in which the March on Washington has come to symbolize, Sam, the goodness of America. We've come so far, and now we're going to celebrate where we are, and hopefully folks will call attention to the crisis that is engulfing Black America at this moment, as opposed to just simply patting themselves on the back.
Yeah, I mean, that is the part that really, I think, you know, that dynamic is one that I think is really sort of playing out in our political consciousness, because, you know, we're at a time where there was reports out today about wage stagnation, and African Americans and the poor have suffered even greater over the course of this recession than obviously the wealthy and white folk, and it seems that there is, I mean, there's a certain amount of frustration that I imagine, I mean, that I feel in that we're talking about, you know, sort of focusing on this notion, and certainly there's plenty, I think, to be proud of in terms of what has happened in this country. There's certainly things to celebrate insofar as, I don't know, 50 years ago, and it seems actually when we say it, a really a long time ago, to imagine the first African American president, but at the same time, we're dealing with problems that seem to be perennially swept under the rug, which is, and in fact, in some ways have been exacerbated when we talk about economics.
Well, Sam, I mean, part of, and you know this, I've been following you for so long, I think you feel the same way that I feel, and that is that there has been a kind of marginalization of genuine progressive and radical tradition in the United States. That what stands in for a radical voice, a progressive voice, is really a kind of center-left voice. And this has really taken place within the context of the Black freedom struggle and how we narrate that struggle in the current moment. So what we really have standing in for the best of the Black freedom struggle in the U.S. is a kind of Black liberal narrative, which really takes as its point of departure, right, a kind of baseline inclusion into the status quo, and what we see as the result of that is that folks who are on the margins, folks who are in the shadows, get left out. And so part of what we do know is that we still have a double-digit unemployment in African American communities. In some areas it's not just simply 13%. Nationally, in some areas, it's close to 18%. Some areas, when we talk about African-American men, it's close to 50%. When we think about what happened in the foreclosure crisis, that really had its root a kind of discriminatory practice in terms of Black folk and brown folk being pushed to these subprime loans, we see that the devastation in terms of just simply the loss of homes, right, when we see who's taking advantage of food stamps, who's taking advantage of government assistance as they try to cut it, particularly in relation to sequestering, you see Black women and Black children, right, suffering disproportionately, Black and brown children, poor people suffering disproportionately. So it becomes a very difficult thing to stomach, right, when we find ourselves in a celebratory mode, when we see so much suffering, right, afoot in the nation, right? And so part of what we have to do in this moment around the celebration of the March on Washington is call attention to not only what was present, but what was absent, what is absent in that celebration. People focus on King's I Have a Dream speech. and they really just reduce it to the I have a dream portion of it, which was really something he's delivered. It was kind of a shtick that he had been delivering prior to that moment, such that Mahalia Jackson can yell to him during the speech, tell him about the dream, Martin,
right,
which is this kind of performative moment. But before he gets to that, what is he saying? We've come to cash a check. Right, he's talking about jobs. He's talking about discrimination. He's talking about structural realities that limit the life chances of people of color. Right? What do we need to? I'm sorry, I'm going on and on.
No. I'm sitting here nodding because, you know, to a certain extent, I have been wrestling with this sort of ambivalence. And when it was announced this morning that Eric Holder is going to be speaking there, on one hand, I think the Department of Justice has been pretty good on balance, and maybe even beyond that, in terms of voting rights and dealing with mm-hmm. the sort of the intense push by the Republicans to disenfranchise black people from voting, aided and abetted by the Supreme Court. On the other hand, not only were black folk steered into subprime mortgages, there was a conscious effort to prey on people in black communities, particularly poor communities who were not financially literate, where the mortgage services took advantage of them. And we have seen virtually nothing from the administration, from Eric Holder, who is in the position to do all of these things. And to hold these mortgage services, these banks, to account. And so I have this intense ambivalence. And when I read, reread Malcolm X mm-hmm. on this march, where he talks about, that the Kennedy had brought to the White House the leaders of some of the biggest black organizations at the time and said, mm-hmm. look, you know, I'm a little concerned about this. Do you guys have control of this? And they said, well, actually, this is not us. Mm-hmm. And there's this move to sort of co-opt this energy and funnel it in a way that is manageable in some fashion.
Well, you think about what prefaces this moment, right? I mean, we had the George Zimmerman verdict, and you remember what happened, right? I mean, you had this amazing kind of expression of discontent, of anger, of rage. You saw this amazing kind of grassroots mobilization across the country as people took to the streets to give voice to their own sense that the criminal justice system was, in fact, and remains decidedly biased when it comes to young black men and women, or black men and women generally. And you saw this. And then what happened, Sam? The president came out and gave a speech. I had the press conference. And for 3-4 news cycles, that's all what people were talking about. And then suddenly Sharpton, who had called for all of these marches, said, okay, let's just focus our attention now on the 24th and the 28th. We're going to bring all of this. And so all of this grassroots energy that was expressed, the energy had been sucked out of the room, except for the Dream Defenders down in Florida.
Yep.
And so you had this moment, and then President Obama steps forward, and then the moment becomes all about him. And what do we get from this, right? We see that by any statistical measure, Sam, under this presidency, black life has not improved. In fact, it has gotten worse by any statistical measure. And the only thing that we hear from President Obama's defenders is that if it wasn't for him, it would be even worse.
Right.
That's the kind of baseline response, because we'll get the standard narrative of what he's done for black folks, right? And that he's the president of all of America, right? But what you see very clearly, in my view, is the demobilization of a black radical tradition as all of the energies get sucked up into this standard liberal narrative about the black freedom struggle, which eventuates in President Obama's ascendancy, or whether it's Attorney General Holder's presence in the Justice Department, while on the ground, everyday ordinary people are suffering in unimaginable ways. And so part of what we have to do, and what I love about this segment in your show and what you always do, is that we have to activate progressive energies. We have to call attention to the absences, right, that will be glaring in this memorialization and celebration of the 50th anniversary. Not only did Malcolm Malcolm X described this as the farce on Washington. Remember, on the eve of the March on Washington, Sam, we will be celebrating the 50th anniversary, or recognizing the 50th anniversary of the death of W.E.B. Du Bois. And Du Bois, that towering African-American intellectual, quit America. He died in Ghana. And he actually sent a letter, right? He actually sent word not to be duped by the march, right? That we had to link our struggle our struggle against racial discrimination to a struggle for economic justice.
Right.
Economic justice rooted not just simply in a certain kind of capitalist imagination, but economic justice rooted, Brother Sam, right, in the sense that everyone should have the ability to earn a decent living and to provide put a home over their head, a roof over their head, and the like. I don't want to get on my little pedestal here, but the March on Washington, the commemoration, is doing political work. And we need to understand clearly what kind of political work exactly. This commemoration is doing.
Exactly.
And as progressives, we have to intervene, and we have to re-narrate this moment. We have to tell a different story about what this march actually represents.
You know, I mean, it's my audience is quite familiar with this, and I quote this often, but, you know, back in 2008, my co-host at the time, Mark Maron, had a great and sadly prescient joke about President Obama, that this is a historic occasion. Finally, African American people are finally going to have the opportunity to be screwed by one of their own, and sadly, it was in many respects very prescient. And you know, when we talk about this, I mean, I think this is exactly. This is exactly why I wanted to talk to you about this sort of this intervention into who owns and dictates the narrative of mm-hmm. of both what the original March on Washington was about and even the impetus for that march, or you know, everything mm-hmm. that preceded that march, and who owns it now. I mean, you mentioned Sharpton. It's actually Sharpton's National Action Network that is sort of has appropriated this mm-hmm. this march, and to the extent that it's actually called the National Action to Realize the Dream. And you know, in my estimation, Al Sharpton, putting aside whether or not he should be the idea of sort of co-opting this, but he has been one of President Obama's greatest defenders in terms of not speaking to these issues of economic justice. And it is, so how does one go about doing this? I mean, when you see the co-optation that happened back in 1963 or 64, right. I guess, or you know, in the years
63,
months
right, right.
62, leading up to it,
yeah.
But how now, when this is almost been sort of, I mean, it's packaged as a media event. I mean, it's hard to find the line between where this is happening in terms of mobilizing people and this being an extension of a special that MSNBC is holding.
Man, you hit it right on the head. It's hard. You know, it's hard to stay away from your liquor cabinet in these times, right?
Yeah,
it's really
exactly.
It's really dark out here. And you know, in some ways, the march is going to be a coronation of Reverend Sharpton. And I've worked with Reverend Sharpton in the past on his radio show as a commentator, but I've been just profoundly disappointed in the way in which, you know, to put it crudely, he's just situated himself as carrying Obama's water in relation to the devastation that's taken place in the community. So part of the work that we have to do, Sam, is exactly what you're doing. And that is, we have to re-narrate. We have to find venues. Because of the fragmentation of the media market, we can do all sorts of things to begin to tell different sorts of stories and understand that it's going to be difficult to break through the white noise, to break through the overarching narrative that's being put out there. But we have to do this sort of work. We have to do this sort of grunt work. And I bring this up because part of what's so beautiful about the March on Washington in 63 is that, and in the March on Washington movement from 41 to 46, is that it reflects the best of the organizing tradition. folk have to ask the question, how did all these folk get there? Right?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't just because somebody put out a call on MSNBC. You know, they didn't have MSNBC, right? Somebody had to organize. Folk were organizing in their local communities. Folks were engaged in the on-the-ground grunt work, trying to mobilize their communities to respond to the conditions of the day. And what's beautiful about the March on Washington, even in 63 when it was co-opted by King, is that it was a clear evidence that the nation, hundreds of thousands of people, black and white, came together and in a public moment declared that Jim Crow in the South was wrong, was evil. And to that extent, that's a good thing. So part of what we have to do is begin to lift up that organizing tradition, lift up the possibilities of genuine interracial coalition, and begin to give voice to what that needs to look like, what that might look like in our current moment. But all that's to say that we're going to be doing that against a very strong headwind.
Right.
I can only tell you, man, it's very difficult to have the kind of criticism that I have or the critique that I have in this moment. People will jump on you and call you a traitor.
Well, that is hating. Well, you know, it's interesting because I mean there are two points, because I want to get to that interracial coalition, because on some level we saw, you know, I think at least in New York, if I remember correctly, it was Occupy that first organized the first hoodie march, at least in New York. And where there was an attempt to draw the economic issues into a sort of a broader narrative. And but I, before we get to that, I want to go back because when we talk about this co-optation of the a radical tradition within African American politics, you know, prior to the election, we had Glenn Ford on from Black Commentator, and he was arguing that, his greatest argument, I think, was that President Obama was even, you know, because using the formation of a lesser of two evils, which, you know, I certainly subscribe to on just an array of issues relative to Mitt Romney. But he said that that President Obama was not the lesser of two evils, but a more perfect evil, in the sense that he was co-opting this energy from a tradition of black progressivism, black radicalism, to the detriment of the broader progressive radical struggle in terms of economics. And and you've hinted at that, you know, those type of claims, those type of perspectives are very difficult to articulate within the context of the black community. I mean, because and for some reasons that are obvious, but talk a little bit more about that, because I think
it's hard, and I think it's hard for a number of different reasons, and we have to be careful in how we make this point, right? Because in some ways what happens is that people become so Obama obsessed that it short circuits kind of nuanced analysis, right? And so there's the assumption that if you are critical of the current situation, current lack of policy vis-a-vis, you know, from the Beltway or just simply the general state of black America, that you are in some ways engaged in a criticism of Obama's failings, right?
Right.
And part of what we have to do, given Republican recalcitrance, given the fact that racism is still alive and well, is somehow circle the wagons around him, right? And so everything becomes, you know, the gravitational pull of Obama is such that everything becomes about him. Even when we're talking about, you know, the devastation in the jobs market, even when we're talking about the criminal justice system and rates of incarceration, or what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow, when we just start going through the data and seeing all the hell that black people are catching, if we call attention to this, then it becomes implicitly or explicitly a criticism of Obama. And in some ways it is.
Right.
But in some ways it has little – it isn't just simply about this guy, right? I've said in public before, I can give less than a damn that we have a black president in the White House, right? I'm really looking for policies that really can address the conditions of the most poor and the most vulnerable, right? So part of the challenge has been this sense that the public space in black America, the deliberative space, has contracted precisely because, and here's the irony, Sam, a kind of identity politics polices, right, what you can say and what you can't say.
Right.
That is to say, some people on the one hand will dismiss identity politics as like this bad stuff. You just can't walk around thinking that black people, because they're black, should be in solidarity with one another, right? But at the same time, there's this kind of implicit identity politics around how we should defend President Obama. And in my mind, you can't defend drones. It's just hard to do,
right?
Especially when you were critical during the Bush administration.
Right.
You can't defend, right, NSA. Right, you can't defend the policies that have defended Wall Street and left Main Street broke. Right, and it seems to me that you just you lose all your moral authority to bring critique to bear on anyone coming after President Obama. So for me, and here is really the point that I think you're reaching for. President Obama has established the way in which future presidents will deal with race for the next generation. So the way black folk have held the state, have engaged the state up until this moment, right, it has completely been arrested because people have compromised their principles in defense of this guy.
You know, it's,
does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it seems it's obviously it's incredibly problematic. And it also seems, I mean, when you talk about the identity politics, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, on one hand, you know, because we're talking about sort of a clash between sort of like political cultural aspects of life that are political and mm-hmm. policy aspects of life that are political. I mean,
right.
for instance, I mean, in the context of, I really believe that one of the best things that has happened to the LGBT community over the past 10, 15 years is the idea of celebrities, of sports figures coming out, of television shows, even sitcoms, portraying gay people as people as opposed to the butt of a joke. And that mm-hmm. has had great implications in changing our culture, which we are now seeing the payoff in terms of policy. We are starting to see the expansion of human rights for gay people. And
mm-hmm.
this seems to be the sort of the tension that exists with President Obama, because clearly, you know, there is an importance to the notion of an African American being president, and just as there will hopefully in the future to a woman being president. But that does not necessarily mean that from a policy standpoint we've caught up, and in some ways it cuts against any progress on a policy level because it almost gets a pass. You know, that like,
right.
like this is enough. The cultural sort of from a cultural perspective, things have progressed. But when the cultural perspective progresses and we don't see it reflected in policy, it begins to undercut the impetus for policy.
Right. I mean, so it's one thing for the president to sing Al Green. You know, to sing an Al Green song in Harlem, but it's another thing for us to get some specific policies to address, right, the conditions of folks on the ground. So, I mean, you know, we know the crack cocaine disparity, right, that has led to the imprisonment of thousands of black folk, and you see those folks recognizing that there was discrimination, there was bias inherent in crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing disparity, but the Justice Department comes through the back door and argues against these folk being released mm-hmm. or having their sentences reduced. So you can sing Al Green on the one hand, but what are the policies on the ground? What are the policies on the ground? You can give a great speech about Trayvon Martin could have been your son or it could have been me, but what are the substantive significant policy issues that go beyond just simply private partner, public-private public partnerships and entertainers and preachers and athletes coming together to do something for black boys, right? Or have we searched our hearts to see if we have given up the, you know, our prejudices so that we can interact with one? What are the concrete policies to prevent the murder of a child, right? And so when you say, when progressives get caught up in symbol, when those, and you know, these shorthands are troublesome, progressive, radical, right, whatever. When people who are principled get caught up in symbol, we oftentimes find ourselves, Sam, compromising those principles that serve as cornerstones for who we take ourselves to be. And it seems to me that so many folks have, to paraphrase, you know, the autobiography of an ex-colored man, so many people have sold their souls for a mess of pottage.
Right.
Right. And what we see around us is just devastation. I mean, poor people, the most vulnerable, and particularly vulnerable children, are catching hell.
And right? I mean, people can look around. Hell. I mean, we can see what's going on in Detroit. We can see what's happened
exactly.
With Rahm Emanuel shutting down 50 schools, and then
Philadelphia is doing the same thing.
Exactly.
Right?
And we're seeing this in Philly as well in terms of attacks on public education. Give me your sense. I mean, this is a hard question, but I mean, and aside from the sort of the corrosiveness of people not maintaining their principles through this time. What happens? Because you're obviously on a daily basis, you're engaging in black political thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at the way that things are organizing, what happens when President Obama is ex-President Obama? I mean, because this is something that,
wow,
you know, I try and think about just in terms of from a political standpoint. And I'm curious from your perspective, you know, what happens at that point? I mean, do suddenly the energy that has been sort of the cross currents sort of meld into a more unified current, or what happens?
Well, you know,
that may be a big question.
Loose. If we think we're in dark times now, what the future holds? You know, I was talking with my good friend Cornel West, and he made a point. And I've been struggling with it, that we may be witnessing the end of Black America as we know it. And
what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean?
Is that what, you know, the traditional ways in which the story or the stories of our sojourn in this country, the ways in which we stood as the moral voice of the nation in some ways, the way in which we have been in but not of the country, and how that status has informed our critique and the way in which we've reared our children and our children's children. All of this is changing as we find ourselves more and more included into the mainstream of American life as it is, not transformed, but as it is. So you have a strata of Black America that is as included and as American as apple pie. And it's not a small strata. There's a growing number of folks. And at the same time, you have a group of folks who are so locked out, so marginalized, so isolated, living in hyper-concentrated and hyper-segregated pockets of poverty, that it becomes difficult for them to imagine the next day or to imagine tomorrow. So the way in which the way in which we've been socialized into understanding who we are as black folk in the United States is changing. And what that's going to look like, particularly post-Obama. In my worst moments, Sam, I say that this administration has had as much of an effect on black politics as the Reagan administration. It has had that kind of effect on changing the scope and nature of black political redress. And we've yet to wrap our minds around it. And we're not going to see its impact until the next administration, whether
right.
it's Hillary Clinton or Cruz or Rubio or Biden or whomever. We won't see its effects until we have to engage the next administration. And the question will be, how will we engage them? What will be the languages we will use? So to answer your question in shorthand, it's going to get even darker for how we imagine African-American politics. And my thinking is that we have to shift to the local. We have to turn our attention away from the national stage as the point of entry and begin to do what we're seeing, like in North Carolina with Moral Mondays. Right. We have to begin to see what's going on in Florida with those young folk. We have to turn to the local, and that must be our perch. And that's the best of the organizing tradition, as I understand it.
And I wonder if that story changes and the way that the relationship that that black folk have to their sense of who they are in America changes, if that doesn't then maybe leave room for more of that coalition building, like we're seeing in North Carolina in many mm-hmm. respects, of economic justice issues. And I mean, because I think, you know, one of the things that seems to be happening in North Carolina is that the issues that are on the plate are issues that are affecting poor people, middle class people. Mm-hmm. Their mm-hmm. economic issues, education issues that speak to black people because of their situation, and I think in the context of voting it may be a little bit different, frankly, but not as much because they are black.
But see, the thing is that we need to understand that the best of the black freedom struggle tradition, Sam, was never just simply about black people.
Right.
The best of the black freedom struggle was about justice. And when we think about what the best of the black freedom struggle made possible, right, we're not only talking about rights for workers, we're talking about rights for women, we're talking about rights for undocumented workers. The best of the black freedom struggle, right, open doors for LGBT community. So when we're talking about the voicing, right, of our demands for freedom, our sense of what American democracy ought to be, I mean, for me, the best voicing of this is, of course, in the writing of James Baldwin, right? It's always about a certain kind of reimagining of America. So what we see in North Carolina, having its beginnings, right, in these voter ID laws, these efforts to disenfranchise black folk, or what we saw with Darian Murray with the Million Hoodie March and how it linked up with the Occupy movement, right, when we see these sorts of connections, what we do know is that the best of the black freedom struggle gives voice to a conception of democracy that cuts across race, class, gender, sexual orientation, that speaks to the best of us. And part of my worry is that that struggle has been hijacked by self-interested persons
right.
who are eyeing, right, getting a better footing among the powers that be.
Indeed.
And leaving the most vulnerable behind, if that makes sense. I know that's a harsh thing to say.
It makes
but
sense.
But I think it's what I feel in my heart.
I share that concern. Professor Eddie Gloud from Princeton, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff.
It's always great to talk with you, Sam.
Pleased to meet you. Hope you guess my name. Oh, yeah. I want buzzing you with the nature of my watch the glee while you kings and queens fought for syndicates for the God's sake. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys?
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Reza Aslan. He is a religion scholar, journalist, and author of the very important new book, Zealot. Reza, how you doing? Thanks for joining us. Hello? Reza? Oh, I'm sorry. Reza, hello?
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great. It's great to be here.
So, Reza, right off the bat, got to get to this book, but I think most of us have probably seen this interview that happened on Fox, and I just feel like we need to get this out of the way. Are you a Muslim?
I am what you would call a secret Muslim.
I think we heard about this.
I understand, you know, all the kind of craziness about this. And I get it. You know, I understand why there are people who are nervous or afraid about the book. But the truth of the matter is that anybody who's read the book can tell you that there's really nothing in there that's an attack on Christianity. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the book deals with Jesus as a historical figure in, I think, what can only be described as, you know, not just sympathetic, but in a devotional way, really.
Yeah, so let's I'm just going to say parenthetically that people like Frank Gaffney would warn us and say, look at how savvy these secret Muslim agents are. But I'm not going to indulge myself. Well, I did by making that joke. But let's get to the book. So this book is fascinating. And what you're doing really is you're taking a, not only not a religious view of the book from any perspective, but you're really trying to work textually and historically and present who this guy actually was. And I think an interesting way that you frame the book is your own story of your relationship with Jesus, which actually surprised me. It began with a conversion experience when you were a teenager. So could you talk about the kind of evolution of your relationship with Jesus?
Yeah. So, you know, my family came to the United States from Iran in 1979. We were, you know, essentially Muslim in the way that a lot of Iranians are, just kind of ethnically or culturally Muslim. We didn't really have that much of a religious life back in Iran, but certainly in the United States, we kind of scrubbed our lives of any kind of hint of Islam at a time in which anti-Muslim sentiment was, you know, pretty high with the whole Iran hostage crisis and everything.
Right.
So I didn't really grow up with much religious instruction, though I was, you know, deeply hungry for kind of a sense of spiritualism. And I, in high school, found that spiritualism when I went to an evangelical youth camp and heard the gospel for the first time, this remarkable story about God coming down in the form of a man and dying for the sins of humanity. I completely absorbed that message, converted to evangelical Christianity, spent the next few years you know, preaching that gospel message to pretty much everyone that I encountered. In college, I went to a Jesuit Catholic university and decided to begin studying the New Testament formally. And it was then that I sort of noticed a distance between the Christ that I had been introduced to in church and this historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, who walked the earth 2,000 years ago in a land that the Romans would call Palestine. And so for me, in this weird way, even though I began to kind of move away from the Christian church, and by no means am I a Christian any longer. In fact, I, with the encouragement of my Jesuit priests at Santa Clara University, went back to the faith of my forefathers, Islam.
Wow. Wow.
But at the same time, I became far more interested in Jesus of Nazareth, this person, than I ever was of Jesus the Christ. And that was kind of the impetus for this book, which, you know, 20 years later is now finally out.
That's fascinating. So what does zealot mean in this context? Because it seems to me that, you know, you've obviously chosen that word for a reason, and that gets to the heart of what your historical claim about Jesus is, that he was in a very specific, really political context and had a kind of nationalist liberation message.
Well, zealotism was a widespread biblical doctrine in first century Palestine. I mean, for the majority of Jews who revered the great heroes and prophets and kings of the Hebrew Bible, these men were all referred to as being zealous for the Lord. What zeal implies was an uncompromising devotion to the Torah, the law of Moses, a refusal to serve any master except the master of the universe, and a commitment to the sole sovereignty of God. In other words, the Hebrew Bible commands the Jews to cleanse the Holy Land of all foreign presence and to dedicate it solely to the chosen people. And it was the zealous warriors of God who defeated the Canaanites and the Amalekites and the Jebusites and all those other tribes to create the land of Israel to begin with. So zealotism in the first century became a very important ideology because, of course, this is a time in which the Romans were living under the boot of a pagan imperial power. They were under direct Roman occupation. And this concept of zeal was used by a number of revolutionaries, messiahs, preachers, prophets, bandits, to rally the Jews to fight back against Rome, to cleanse the Holy Land, to remove the yoke of occupation from the Jews. And by the way, in 66 CE, this actually finally worked. The Jews rose up in revolt and managed to kick the Romans out of Jerusalem and keep them at bay for about 3 or 4 years before they returned and pretty much slaughtered everyone and burned the city to the ground. Right. The argument of the book is that that sentiment, that idea of zeal for the Lord and the desire to rid the land of the Roman occupation is deeply a part of Jesus's teachings and actions. It's a framework for understanding not just who he was, but what he was trying to do.
And connected with that, that Jesus was this political figure, essentially. That's what you're saying. And that in terms of how we identify Jesus in a modern context, that it's very appropriate to see him on the side, very unequivocally, not just even like in a charitable, oh, he cared about the poor, the downtrodden, because he was so compassionate sense, but that, no, this was literally the ideology that he was a part of enacting and creating in that time, and that was his message fundamentally.
Well, to be clear, in Jesus's time, there was no difference between religion and politics. They were one and the same. The kind of simple divisions that we understand today did not exist for Jesus. So simply saying the phrase, "I am the Messiah," was not just a religious statement. It was also a profoundly political statement. Messiah means the anointed one. The principal task of the Messiah is to recreate the kingdom of David. So if you're claiming to be the one sent by God to usher in God's kingdom on earth, then what you're also saying is that you're here to usher out the kingdom of Caesar. They would have seen those statements as one and the same. So it's not so much an argument that Jesus was, quote, a political figure, not a religious one. It's a reminder to modern readers that the context in which Jesus lived, his actions, his words, his teachings, were such that everything he said would have been profoundly political.
That's fat. And then just the kind of one, another, I think, important piece of this is the image that we have of Jesus that is more in the popular imagination and traditional theology, is that a product of St. Paul or Roman figures in Christianity almost like rebranding this figure in a way that would be more appealing for a kind of Rome-based cosmopolitan religion? Is that where the kind of makeover happens?
Well, I think that's a great way of putting it. I mean, we have to remember that the followers of Jesus, the men and women who walked with him and talked with him, who you know, ate with him, who shared his bread, who were there when he began his movement, who were there when he was arrested and crucified, were, like Jesus, mostly illiterate, uneducated peasants, farmers, fishermen, day laborers. And so, as a result, these were people who would not have the ability to either read or write about Jesus and their experiences, or for that matter, to even, you know, espouse complex theological doctrines about him and what he meant and what his, you know, ideology stood for. That task actually fell to a second and third generation of Christians who, unlike Jesus's Aramaic-speaking peasant followers, were mostly Greek-speaking Jews who did not live in the Holy Land, but instead lived in the diaspora, in these deeply Hellenized, Romanized, cosmopolitan urban cities like Antioch and Alexandria, Rome and Philippi and Corinth, etc. These were Jews who were steeped in Greek and Roman traditions and culture, and when they began to write about Jesus, to talk about Jesus, to spread the message of Jesus, they did so with a deeply Hellenistic influence. And, more importantly, they did so increasingly addressed to a non-Jewish audience, to a Gentile audience instead, to a Roman audience. And frankly, this Roman audience was much more familiar with the kind of Jesus that they were talking about, this sort of Romanized demigod, this detached celestial spirit with no concerns about the cares of this world, than the Jews who lived with him and talked with him recognized themselves. And so you're right. What we kind of know about Jesus, what we know about Christianity, was sort of launched by people who didn't actually know Jesus while he was alive.
That's fascinating. I think, Matt, go ahead, jump in.
So this past Friday was, I believe, you were on Fox News. And, I mean, when they contacted you, I'm sure you had a feeling what they were going to get at here. Am I right?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm familiar with Fox News for sure. And they did a few days before the interview, they published an attack piece on me. So I kind of had an idea what I was getting into.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing to me that they – like, I can't even count how many times they had to bring up that, and you're a Muslim. As if – I mean, you said it on the second page. You mentioned how you're a Muslim, as if it even matters to begin with. But, I mean, it's not like you were even a secret Muslim, even though that's what we joke about. I mean, you are out in the book.
You're out in your entire professional
profile.
I do
mention in, like, the second page of the book that, yes, that I am a Muslim.
Do they even realize that Jesus is a historical figure? And also, I mean, in Islam, Jesus is a prophet. It's not like you're just – I mean, it's not like you're even just discussing Christianity with this book by talking about Jesus.
Right. Well, so, yeah, you brought up two very, very good points. Number one is that, yes, absolutely, Muslims believe that Jesus was a prophet. In fact, you know, this most of the gospel story in a kind of Reader's Digest version of it can be found in the Quran. But on a larger point, I'm not writing this book from a Muslim perspective or from a Jewish or Christian perspective at all. I'm writing it from a scholarly perspective. I'm a scholar. It's what I do for a living. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I mentioned in that interview, there's a lot of things that I talk about Jesus that actually violate core Muslim ideas about Jesus. And I've had a lot of Muslims who were upset with the book and what I say about the historical Jesus. So, you know, I think it's just, A, factually incorrect that this book is some sort of Muslim account of Jesus. There are some, you know, books out there about the Muslim Jesus, and this isn't one of them. And B, I think sort of, you know, the philosophical backbone of the question is that it would be impossible for someone to write about Jesus without some kind of faith-based, you know, prejudice. And I would say that, you know, a lot of scholars who are Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, and atheist who write about religious figures have been doing this for centuries. I mean, it's kind of weird to all of a sudden talk about it as though only practitioners of a faith can write about the prophets of that faith. If that were true, then there would be a lot fewer Islam books out there.
Right, there would be almost none in the in America. I think a final question that I want to get to you on this specifically, though, is it seems to me that this is the tip of a campaign to really not allow, in some respects, Muslims to function in civic space in America, whether it's building a, you know, progressive and pluralistic mosque on Ground Zero, or saying, hey, you're a religion scholar, but forget it, you have a certain, you know, you're Muslim, you can't write this book. I think that's what's been so darkly hilarious, but also just shocking about how naked this outburst has been. And I would just add as an addendum, everybody should go and buy this book through the Majority Report link on Amazon and buy Zealot, and also write a response to some of these just like obscene reviews that are on the site that are the foot soldiers of the Fox interview, so to speak.
Yeah, this is, I mean, look, I wish I could say that this is new. It's not new. I mean, I've been dealing with this pretty much my entire professional life, there are a very well-coordinated, very well-funded cabal of organizations and individuals, often referred to as the Islamophobia industry, that right. have made me a target of their fun. And you know, I deal with this all the time. I think the knives have come out perhaps a little bit more strongly because in this particular case, rather than talking about Muhammad or Islam, I'm talking about Jesus and Judaism, not necessarily Christianity, because as I have to constantly remind people, Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was a Jew. This book is not about Christianity. The book is about Judaism, actually. And, you know, it's kind of expected. I mean, I'm not in any way surprised at the level of vitriol that I have received. And, yeah, you're right. My Amazon page has been hijacked by really a handful of people with about 100 fake handles who are just cutting and pasting the same vitriol over and over again. And you know, hopefully people will go on there and you can report abuse on those comments. And I mean, I would hope eventually that Amazon would recognize what is going on the page and will do something about it, but I don't really have any say in that.
Right. Well, Reza Aslan,
Before you go, actually, yes, I just want to say thank you so much for providing that entertainment on that program. I mean, that might be one of the greatest.
Yeah, you handled that amazingly
really
well.
It might have been one of the greatest Fox, any sort of right-wing media smackdown I've ever seen. It's legendary.
And also, the right should thank you because you gave them the idea of a PhD in Reagan, which anybody who watches it will know what I'm saying. I'm sure that they appreciate it in spite themselves.
Happy to serve. Happy to serve.
Reza Aslan, thank you so much. Everybody should buy Zealot. It's a fascinating book. And as my grandmother, Jewish grandmother, would say, Jesus was a lovely man and he said nothing new. So thank you so much, Reza.
Guys. Great to talk to you.
Take care.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
I want to play a couple of clips from a show. It's a show that's on.
I believe it's called like the Locked and Loaded Gun
Locked
Show.
Locked and Loaded. Okay. It's called Locked and Loaded. And this is a show. I guess it's promoting guns. And on this episode, they're checking out the cricket rifle for four-year-olds. Let's listen to the first clip of this.
Hi there, you are watching Lock and Load. I'm your host, Brandy Vega. If you like what you see here, please tell your friends. Also, leave a comment. Let us know what gun you'd like to see featured. Today's episode is all about youth rifle. Giving guns to kids. This is a small gun. Clark, we might get some feedback.
We might. We might get some feedback about giving a child a gun. However, under proper supervision, under the right circumstances, it's totally appropriate.
When is a good age to give a kid their first gun?
Now, as a parent, you're going to know.
And what are the main safety rules? If you can give one or two things, what is
muzzle direction, trigger finger. Teach your child that don't let that muzzle point at or cover anything you don't want a hole in. And a little kid can understand that. And then teach them where to put their trigger finger. Keep it off of the trigger until they're ready to shoot.
What is the first gun a parent should give their kid?
Well, I mean, that's up to them. A lot of people think BB guns or pellet guns. However, you get into a complacency with them because they are dangerous. And so I chose a .22.
Okay, there's three things here I want to point out before we do the second clip. One is, apparently, according to this guy, as a parent, you're going to know the age that your child should have a gun. I want people to keep that in mind when they think about what we're going to hear in the next clip in that same show. As a parent, you're going to know. Now, apparently, Stephanie Sparks, the parent of this five-year-old who shot his two-year-old daughter, sister, she didn't quite know. So we should keep that in mind. The other two things about safety, this is the two most important things for safety when you're talking about kids and guns. Apparently, it's muzzle direction and trigger finger. Not
don't let the kids use the guns when you're not there. Lock them up, not to have some other type of safety features. It's just that when they're playing around with a gun, just tell them not to point it at somebody.
Right.
And then he claims that kids are going to understand this, that if you pull the gun and they shoot them, that it's going to put a hole in. The kids are going to understand this, according to this guy.
Of course they do.
Yeah, of course they know. Except for the woman who is interviewing him, as she explains literally 2 minutes later in this same show.
I think you're right. I don't think we're growing up in that same type of a gun-friendly, if you will, almost a gun-taboo type culture now.
Right, and we spoke about safety, and I wanted to share a really quick story, not a very good one. If you have guns in your home, you do have to be very careful. As a child, 6 years old, my mom had a gun. She thought it was hidden. It was loaded. It was hidden under a mattress. I knew about it. We were alone one day. My sister made me mad. I found that gun. I chased her around the house with a loaded gun at 6 years old, not really knowing the consequences. And so even though we talk to the kids, we need to make sure we're safe in keeping these guns locked up if you have them in your home, because I could have easily tripped or pulled the trigger, and it could have been devastating. So that's my little don't do this one at home story.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though, and our, well, sisters, you know, I mean, sisters, I've seen some things that rival the Iraq War with sisters. But this is a deadly weapon. This is a dangerous weapon and a deadly weapon. That needs to be emphasized.
But it's also fun, and it's a good family bonding, and it's good to learn the fundamentals when you're young, because then you can carry that with you.
Cut it. All right, did people understand what just happened here? This woman who was doing this thing just told a story of when she was six, she had no concept of what she was doing when she was holding this gun. She was chasing her sister around, could have easily pulled that trigger, could have accidentally pulled this trigger and killed her sister. And she's right sitting here promoting this stuff. How low and despicable or stupid do you have to be? And then this dude, who is shocked that she has told this story to him, is like, well, sisters, they're like Iraq.
You know, like, because it's just those girls and that stupid stuff they do.
Are you kidding me? This is just, like, that woman, first of all, I hope she got paid millions and millions of dollars. I hope she's swimming in money. She can't breathe. There's so many dollar bills in her mouth because, God forbid, her kid ever gets killed by a gun in that situation. And she realizes, oh, I guess I didn't learn the lesson. I mean, that's just stunning to me. This is a religion to these people. This is a religion to these people.
That's right.
And they do not care. And it involves human sacrifice, and they do not care. I want to give you a warning. What we're about to play is explicit. If you have children listening to the program right now, or if you yourself are, a child, you may want to turn down the volume on this. And we will post this on YouTube as well. In lieu of reposting this man's video, we will use stills so as not to infringe upon his copyright or his sense of decency. This is Gilberton, Pennsylvania Police Chief Mark Kessler. The first clip we have of him, he is sending a message to John Kerry and the UN about his AK-47, I think he's holding. If I don't have the make of that gun proper, forgive me. I guess I didn't pay attention to the gun so much. Here he is, Police Chief Mark Kessler, reading from a script and then tearing it up as if it was a prop. And then, well, then you'll see or hear. Here we go.
I want to make this video today because they're at it again. They just don't know when to quit. And neither do we. Kerry says U.S. will sign U.N. treaty on arms regulations despite lawmakers' opposition.
Pause. You should know this arms treaty had to do with arms sales internationally, would not have affected any guns inside the U.S. But something tells me that the police chief of Gilberton, Pennsylvania, doesn't listen to such reason. Continue.
Secretary of State John Kerry, that piece of shit traitor. Who is he to decide what we can and can't own? And fuck the UN. Who are they to decide what we, the American people, can own? I have a message to Kerry. Any of these cocksuckers over in the UN. Here's your fucking agreement. Sign anything you want to sign. It's not going to mean shit. It don't fucking mean shit to me. You know what I have to say? Come and take it, motherfuckers! Come and get it!
There's no explanation as to why the police chief of Gilberton was shooting into the side of a hill as he was expressing this. If he really wanted to be effective, what he should have done is shot into the camera.
I was really expecting him to end it with, like, Merry Christmas, you filthy animal.
Right, take this, you!
And a Happy New Year.
So, apparently, the police chief, Kessler, is not done. And again, I want to say that if you're listening to the podcast right now, you might want to turn down the volume or skip ahead a couple of minutes, because this is not safe for work as well. And if you're watching it, you may want to turn down the volume. We will use photographs again. To express what the police chief, you should know that the mayor of Gilberton, Pennsylvania, Mary Lou Hannon, according to a Raw story, told the Morning Call that Kessler had the right to express himself, that the city would not take any action to quash free speech, whether or not each member of council or member of any council agrees with it. Let me ask you a question. If you were a citizen of this town, would you want this guy to be your police chief?
Fuck all you libtards out there. As a matter of fact, read my shirt. Get a good look at that.
Okay.
This libtard, he's taking in the ass. And I don't give a fuck what you say. So he's going to go fuck yourselves. Period. I won't be going to D.C. And I don't give a fuck. You fucking maniacs want to turn this into a armed revolt. Knock yourselves out. I'm not about that. So, see you on the other side.
Now, let me try and decipher for you what the police chief of Gilberton, Pennsylvania, is saying here. He starts by giving us all the finger, particularly us libtards. And then he has a T-shirt, which he had made up. I don't know if it's on one side. It has like a little Confederate flag patch over the breast, and on the back it says "Libtards take it up."
This one just says "liberals."
Oh, liberals take it up the ass. I do not believe that is his police uniform.
Although we are talking about Gilbert,
it's possible. And apparently he wanted to have a he was calling for a massive rally on his Facebook page in Washington to show these tyrants we will not stand for any more violations of our Constitution or our freedoms. Apparently somebody must have said, hey, don't go to Washington. That would be embarrassing for the town. And he says, fine. And when he says, I'll see you on the other side, and blames people who are doing nothing for an armed revolt, which he seems to be quite excited about participating in. He says, I'll see you on the other side. I don't know if this is a suicide note or what, but I hope by the other side he means when I am fired from my position as police chief of Gilberton, Pennsylvania, which apparently has no libtards as citizens. Just amazing. Kudos to you, sir. I don't even know what to say about that.
This guy needs. This guy at the very least needs a lesson on putting together events. If you're going to set up an event in Penn State, I'm not going. I mean, you're not very good at putting together events.
No.
We listen in the.
That's what we call event tard.
It's Sam Cedar introducing whiny ass teeny baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives, that's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Let's go to the phones. You're calling from 469 area code. Who's this?
Jessica from Texas.
Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Good.
What's up?
I just wanted to call about the whole libertarian challenge thing.
Okay. Are you a libertarian?
Yes.
Okay. So what do you want to what is it that I've said about libertarians that you might want to dispute in any way?
Well, it seems that whenever you talk about free markets with people and the government's involvement in the market, seems like there's like confusion about how the government should be involved in the markets in general.
And how do you think the government should be involved in the market?
Well, the purpose of government is to protect property rights and punish fraud and theft, basically. So the government should be involved to protect property rights, but they shouldn't interfere with voluntary exchanges, basically.
So they shouldn't be involved in contracts at all?
Well, they should. They're there to enforce contracts, too.
Okay. But they shouldn't impede contracts. So let me ask you this. What happened in Michigan? Do you have a problem with the so-called right-to-work statutes? You must, right?
Right-to-work statutes? I don't know. I don't really know much about that issue. Could you explain what the
Well, let's talk about something that you do know about. I mean, what is it that you do you have a problem with? Do you think our government is overreaching in some fashion?
I mean, you talk about the FDA a lot, right?
I mean, on occasion, yes. Do you have a problem with the FDA?
I mean, if a person wants to use a drug that's not FDA approved, I think they should be able to,
Yeah. I mean, you think that there should be no government testing to make sure that medication is safe?
I would be okay with government testing if they wanted to and if it was funded through voluntary contributions. I just don't think that they should prevent drugs from being sold.
Let's presume if you had an agency that was testing just by voluntary voluntary funding, you couldn't really necessarily trust that, right? I mean, if I came to your town and was selling snake oil and I said, this is an elixir that's going to cure your cancer, and I have the testing results to prove it. I funded this test and it came out fine. So you just think that it's somehow inhibiting people's, so you don't think there's any value in knowing whether or not a drug is safe by at least theoretically disinterested party?
I think there's value in that, and I think that private agencies could do the same thing the government's doing now. I mean, I don't see why a ratings agency that just rated or tested drugs, and gave their own seal of approval would be any more likely to be corrupt than the FDA would.
I'm not sure I follow what you're saying with rating agencies, but I mean, why do you think that we have an FDA? Do you think that things worked out better before we had an FDA to determine whether or not drugs were safe? I mean, what would you do with thalamide babies, for instance? Do you know what thalamide babies are?
Not really.
Are you familiar with is it thalamide? I think it was called. It was a drug given to pregnant women. And was not sufficiently studied. I think it was actually taken off the market in Europe. I think. I'm not. I may be confused about it. But the point is that
Basically, babies were born with tremendous birth defects because of this drug. Now, I suppose if we have no FDA testing on it and going back, I don't know how this drug would be taken off. I mean, who would be the one to point out that this is happening?
Well, I mean, I'm sure the people who bought it, I don't know, does the drug company tell the people that it's safe whenever they sell it to them, that it won't have any side effects? Or, I mean, if they told them that it's safe and then it has negative effects, they could always sue for fraud because, you know, nobody takes the drug expecting it to give them birth defects. But, yeah.
Right. And how would they know?
There'd probably be a lot more guarantees that would, you know, be subject to lawsuits if there was no FDA approval. I mean, that was an FDA-approved drug, right? Or was it?
I mean, I believe it may have been, but it was ultimately the FDA that took it off the market.
Do people want to continue taking it after it was shown to be causing birth defects anyway?
Well, I don't think people knew that it was. I think it was a function of the FDA that took it off the market.
Well, I think if there were no FDA, I'm sure there would be websites that people could go to look up.
But there was no web. There was no internet at the time. So you're saying that just the internet has made. You're just saying that the internet. The internet, and I should say the FDA never licensed thalidomide for general use.
All right.
I mean, so people ended up taking this drug because it was supposedly good for pregnant women, and it was supposedly like a wonder drug for insomnia and coughs and colds and headaches. And it was supposed to, it was given to, pregnant women for, you know, like when you feel, morning sickness. And so it ended up creating these horrible, birth defects.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the FDA, you know, whenever they, hold drugs back for long periods of time, that hurts people too, though. You know, if they hold back a drug that can, you know, cure people with an illness for like 7 years, they can end up killing, you know, hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, no, I know they hold back drugs to test their efficacy, but I mean, do you really think that drugs should just be allowed to go on the market with no testing and just like, you know, you get if you get birth defects, you sue. But you know what? That's not necessarily, you know, if you got a birth defect from a drug that your mother took because a company lied about it, do you really think that if you have no arms, let's say, that it's going to be some type of consolation that, but I'm at least rich?
Probably not, but that's just how lawsuits work. I mean, they can't predict, you know, the fraud so much.
No, I know. That's why I'm saying that lawsuits are not an effective way of dealing with the idea that people could be given drugs that are dangerous to them.
But if you just have an organization like the FDA that holds drugs back until they're absolutely sure that they're, you know, 100% safe, you're going to hurt people too by holding back good drugs for a long period of time. I mean, it's not going to be a perfect solution.
Do you think that on balance, if you had no one examining drugs and companies which have been shown to put out drugs, even after they know, test after test, even though they know that maybe they have to settle some lawsuits and that's just going to be the cost of doing business, do you think on balance it is healthier for the population to have an agency that is making sure that these drugs are not harmful? Or do you think that the wonder drugs that you anticipate that are being held up by the FDA would provide more benefit on balance?
Well, I mean, I really have no way of knowing that, but I mean, I've heard statistics, or not statistics, I've heard estimates that like certain, like the FDA blocked the use of beta blockers as heart medication for 7 years, and that's been estimated to result in the death of like 119,000 people. So I don't know if any drug they released early killed that many people or not, but that's just one example.
So you just don't think there should be any testing period We should just put drugs. We
should just allow drugs. I just think that
we should. I mean, what you're suggesting is
private agencies.
You're just saying, but what wouldn't that private agency spend a certain period of time to make sure that the drugs are safe?
Yeah, they would. But the only difference is that if a drug is out on the market and you're dying of a terminal illness and you want to try it, and a private agency hasn't approved it, that doesn't mean that you're not allowed to try it. The FDA prevents you from trying things that you want to try. I mean, I think people should be free to use what they want. If they think something's going to help them, they should be able to try it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that's an interesting opinion. So I've got a pill that'll cure everything that ails you. And if it ends up really hurting you, you can sue me. Or I may just go, bankrupt my company and walk away. You really think that's a more efficient? You think that's really a more efficient way of protecting people's health?
What did you say about he might just what to his company?
Well, I'm going to create a pill that's going to solve all your problems. You're going to take it. You're going to find that it gives you a lot of side effects. You know what? I didn't know. I'm the company. I didn't know it creates side effects. I mean, look, wanted to take it.
Like I said, they could have, companies that test the effectiveness of drugs like the FDA does.
Yeah, I had my producer. He set up a company where he tests the effectiveness of drugs. He said it was okay.
Well, come on. I mean, this is, ridiculous. I mean, people don't have to take a drug if it's, there's some shady stuff behind who's...
What makes you say it's shady?
Like, if a guy makes up a company and sells some drug and makes ridiculous claims about it, then, there's another...
That's called?
It's
business.
It's just some random agency that approved it. I just don't think people are that gullible and,
Well, I mean, I think you're living in a world where, I don't know if it's just sort of like you're not aware of basically this happens all the time and that the FDA stands in between people putting out dangerous drugs. I mean, even there's many times where they're not even capable of stopping that. Vioxx, Yaz, the list goes on and on. Fen-Phen. The list goes on and on of these drugs. And yes, I guess we could live in a world where it's just Russian roulette. You take a drug. If it turns out bad, you're still alive. Maybe you can sue the company. Maybe you can't. Maybe the company just goes bankrupt. I mean, there's a lot of businesses that sell, the con artists out there who they sell a product. The company goes bankrupt. They come back out and do it. Maybe they pay a couple of fines. Maybe they pay, they make a settlement with somebody and they just keep doing business.
All right. But I mean, you have to know that there are drugs that are held back and that ends up killing people.
Yes,
too.
Sure. There's no doubt in my mind that there are drugs that could be helping people that are held back so that we can be sure that our drug supply is safe. Of course. Even under the private voluntary process that you're talking about, those drugs would be held back.
In some ways,
why are these companies spending so much time developing this? They should just put it out there when they even have the idea and just see how it works. Right? I mean, supposedly internally they take time to develop it. They're wasting their time too, aren't they?
No, they're not wasting time because if a drug company just released a bunch of hazardous drugs, I mean, they're not going to last long if people just keep getting sick every time they take them.
So?
I mean, they know that they have an interest in making sure that they're safe.
You are just not aware of, then how do you explain things like Vioxx? How do you explain things like Yaz? How do you explain things like the Ford Pinto? How do you explain things like thimaldamide. I mean, companies do this all the time.
They do it intentionally, or they just imperfect?
Intentionally. In other words, we know that it's going to cost us X number of dollars to fix the Ford Pinto from exploding when it's banged in from behind. And we know that if we have to settle this case, ultimately it's going to cost Y. Well, Y is less than X, so we're just going to wait. companies make that decision every day. Every day. You've got to educate yourself on this. Go read about the Ford Pinto.
Go read. I'm aware that the Ford Pinto probably wasn't the safest car in the world, but I mean, it was probably, you know, it would probably cost more. You can always make improvements to a car to make it safer, you know, but some people want a cheap car, even if it's not safe, probably, right? I mean, not everybody wants every single safety feature that they can get.
This was a defect. Cars are not supposed to, their gas tanks are not supposed to explode upon a slight impact from behind. Go Google Ford Pinto.
Was it, I mean,
and you should educate yourself
about it. People buy cars, I don't really know all the, I'll Google Ford Pinto, but
yeah.
I mean, did the car company tell people that it was going to explode? I mean, it seems like failure to disclose important information.
No, they didn't tell people that it was going to explode. They found out about it.
I can see that being considered a form of fraud that would be, you know, punishable by law if they didn't tell people.
Well, they were sued. But, you know, the way our corporate structure is set up, very, very hard to get criminal liability for officers of a company in that situation. They were sued. They paid out, but it is considered the classic case, the classic tort case in this country, where it shows the weighing that a company does. Is it cheaper for us just to pay out for the number of deaths that we anticipate this is going to create versus actually fixing a problem we know exists? And they just do a number calculation. Yeah, what are you going to do? All right, well, listen, I appreciate the phone call.
All right.
But you should call back after you read about the Ford Pinto and see if it changes your mind. If it doesn't, I'd be curious to know why.
All right, I might do that.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah.
Now, folks, it's just one of those days where we're just going through the right-wing lunacy. Last week, we played for you the video of Police Chief Mark Kessler, the head of the Gilberton Police Department in Pennsylvania. He had posted a couple of videos, one referring to libtards, saying that they take it up the arse. He also said that John Kerry was a traitor, bashed the UN, and to highlight his point, fired off several dozens of rounds of an automatic rifle into what appeared to be a hill or something. I don't know. It was off camera. You can't really tell. In addition to being the town's police chief, he's the head of the Constitution Security Force, a 100-man militia that vows to protect gun rights in the small town. After Kessler's videos were posted, residents of the town, you know, went to their town council and said, hey, we may have a problem here with the guy who's supposed to be our police chief talking about libtards and ostensibly the problem was that he was using police department property for his personal use. In other words, he was firing these police department guns
in his video
to talk about libtards in the UN. apparently he got suspended for a month, and I think he still is on suspension now. But he shot another video to ostensibly apologize. We have that video. We will play the clip for you now. Understand, when there's silence, he's walking off, just so that you know. Here we go. We'll narrate a little bit.
Well, I guess I upset a few people the other day when I made a video. I used some profanity, and some people didn't like that. Well, I'm here to say I'm sorry. Okay, I didn't mean to upset anybody or insult anybody or hurt anyone's feelings. So please accept this as my sincere apology.
And this is where he walks off camera.
That seemed very, very nice.
That was very sweet of him to say.
Wow. I wonder if he's what he's probably going around to turn off the camera, isn't he? Or
oh, wait, he's back.
Wait, here he comes.
Yeah. I don't think so. This boy don't roll that way. For all you people out there who cried and cried about, oh, I use profanity. Fuck you. Here's what I gotta say. If you didn't get enough the first time around, go fuck yourself and get some more. You get that? You get that one? Huh? You bunch of fucking cocksuckers.
Oh, boy.
He's walked off again.
He's walked off again. Of course, he had an
automatic
weapon. I guess
he's
going to
shut the camera off now.
He's going to shut the camera off. I should have said up front, I should have done a warning on this. On the
audio. Wait, he's back.
Oh, just in case. You missed that?
He's got another one.
I have another message for you.
He's got another automatic weapon.
Go fuck yourself again. How about that?
He's walked off again. This
he's walked
be
off.
It. This has
to be it.
Yeah, it has to be it. Wait a second.
Wait.
Here he comes back.
I think he's shutting off the camera. I think that is it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Oh, what's that noise? What's going on?
He must be loading a...
Oh, he's back.
Huge magazine.
It's a little handgun.
He's got a...
I'm really hurting some feelings today. Oh, you fucking liptards out there. Oh, you fucking crybabies. Grow a pair of balls and man the fuck up. All right? You're a fucking bunch of pussies. Oh, Chief Kessler said the F word. I'm going to say it again. Fuck you.
Oh, my God. That's a handgun.
Yeah, he's got a handgun with a huge magazine loaded to it.
Wow. Now he's done.
Now he's done. Well, Chief Kessler, come and get some of this, buddy. Come and get some of this. These two highlighters.
Our weapon of choice.
That's right. Come and get some of this where I highlighted this piece about you. Where apparently residents of the town said, he's a nut. I don't feel safe with him at all. Another resident said that even Kessler's wife fears him. She's afraid of him, he said. Kessler is a detriment to this borough. Residents then delivered a petition signed by 20,000 people demanding that Kessler be removed from his position within the police department. Come and get this. You can pry these two yellow highlighters out of my cold, dead hands.
Mark, honey, can you take out the trash? Well, fuck you.
I guess signing that petition hurt your feelings and... We're sorry about that.
Yeah, boom.
Oh, wait.
Who? All right, let's finish off with some IMs here.
I wonder how they're reviewing his suspension after that video. I think it's going well.
Yeah, suspension seems to be working.